I am a native Rhode Islander, but well, thank you for that very nice introduction. Sort of backwards through my life. I am a native Rhode Islander, but I've been away for many, many years, and I feel very proud of myself for having found the library this evening. I took the airport exit onto the Post Road and circled around and around by the Greenwood Inn and Main Avenue and some funeral home. And anyway, here I am, pleased to be here. And I can't pass up the opportunity to tell a little joke, and that is that I was introduced as having grown up in Rhode Island. And someone asked me that question when I first came back here from California in 1998. They said, "I heard you grew up in Rhode Island." And I said, "I didn't grow up, I was just raised there." Which is something anybody from Rhode Island can understand. I'm going to start with a kind of a quiz. And I've had a five-minute conversation with Henry Brown, so I think I'm going to declare him ineligible for this quiz, except as a possible last resort. And I'll start with an easy question first, and then we'll just work our way up to some more difficult questions. And the easy question was, or is, what was Airport Road before it became Airport Road? Great. Okay, a little bit harder. What does that mean in Narragansett?
Watch out, here comes an airport.
Sorry? By the way, I wear hearing aids. I injured my ears in the Civil War. I forgot to bring them tonight, so you're going to have to yell. And I'm probably yelling louder than I should so I can hear myself. But what did the Narragansett word Occupastuxet mean?
Stream to which meadows flow? A stream to which a flows through a meadow?
It means a little cove to which a stream flows with salt water or near the salt water, something like that. Okay. We're going to get a little harder now. What was West Shore Road known as before it was known as West Shore Road?
Pequon Path.
Sorry?
Pequon Path.
I think that was the Post Road. Okay.
Mark Rock.
Yes, it was known as Mark Rock Road. And why was it known as Mark Rock Road? I'll give you a hint. In North Kingston, there's a place called Stony Lane that was named because there are a lot of stones there. The English who named many of the locations in this area were very direct in terms of how they named things. Okay, so Mark Rock Road then, what does that mean? Yeah, that's right. There's a rock there that has pictographs. The native peoples of New England did not have their own writing system before John Eliot and other English arrived here and began to translate their languages into a written script. And so in order to be able to talk about the Native Americans in this region, we really have to rely on sources that weren't initially written by them, were written by people from other cultures and backgrounds. Unfortunately, in looking at the Native American record, there's little of the written word that goes back to the earliest times. So in trying to understand what this area was like in the earliest times, it's sort of like it's a real challenge. Some of it is archaeology, and some of it is working backwards from books that were written at a later date. Like Roger Williams was probably the most skillful and knowledgeable observer of Native cultures in southern New England. But he was writing at a time when the native peoples had already been exposed to three or four different European nations and had been trading and had been involved with all sorts of other religious and economic activities and so forth. So by the time Roger Williams was describing them, he was describing a world that had already substantially changed. And the reason why I mentioned Mark Rock is because I'm sure that if one knew how to read that, that there'd be a story there. It quite characteristic of Native American petroglyphs around the United States, that they concern mythical motifs and the origins of ancestors and wanderings of the creators and things of that sort. And I'm sure that that story, that that rock would have a story to tell if we could only read it. Yes?
The word Kokomokasik, which is where Smith's Castle is at, means place of Mont Rock. Oh. So would that have been a referral to get them to Kokomokasik, which was a large trading area, even before the white men came in?
Henry? Henry and I are both hard of hearing. Yes. I would guess that that's right, but I couldn't say. My next question, but I think you probably all know the answer to that, and that is, where is it? And it's anyway. So we'll pass on that. Here's my favorite question, the one I've been working on.
We don't know the answer to that.
Oh, you don't know where? Okay. It is at the end of Yale Street, where it goes to Beach Road. I think it's Beach Road, and it's just south of Occupastuxet Neck.
You take Rock Avenue to the end and walk along the shore?
Correct. Yeah, it's a big ledge of rock by the tide line. It's like the Dighton Rock. I mean, it's a really remarkable stone, and it's kind of surprising to me that it's not better known in Rhode Island than it is. The Dighton Rock in Massachusetts has an entire monument built over it, and it's nothing, certainly not any more elaborate than this amazing stone in Warwick. Okay, the third question. What famous personality in the general Warwick, Shawmut, Patuxet area lived at 145 Payne Avenue in Warwick? Sorry? Gonna have to say it more loudly because I really.
Samuel Gordon, just a guess.
Samuel Gordon?
Yeah.
No?
I know there was an Indian chief's fort on Payne Avenue.
I'm sorry?
I know the Indian chief fort pumpkin was on Payne Avenue. But I don't know the resident of that right there.
You're warm. 145 Payne Avenue is the site of Pomham's Fort. Easy to find. You probably all know the story that in the 1640s, Massachusetts Bay Colony, that was allied with Pomham, who was an important sachem from this area, because he was under threats of attack by Narragansetts and other nearby Native American people. Now, the people of Massachusetts Bay Colony, who were allied with Pomham, offered to defend him, and they built a fort on his behalf. And the actual location of that fort is in lot number 145 on Payne Avenue, just at the end of, I guess, what's called Fort Street or Fort Road or something like that, on Warwick Cove.
Why was it built in that location?
Why at that location? You know, I wonder the same thing myself. I mean, it's hard.
No, because I've gone out there on that site and looked around, and the only thing I can see is that's the two closest points in the cove. So it's probably, I think I made it from one side.
Yeah.
It's a short distance to the well.
Yeah.
It seemed to make sense to me.
It's hard to figure. And also, it's so small that if anyone was under siege inside there, I mean, I would want to get out of there as fast as I could if there was a threat of danger. It's kind of a puzzle. But it may have been a mark of status or something like that, because forts were built all over Long Island Sound, along the Connecticut coast, and even in Rhode Island back in the 17th century, that may have been more places where people met for important discussions than for actual military purposes. So who knows, it could have been that, but I don't know. According to Massachusetts Bay, they built it to defend them.
Know the, I don't know, that a true or more solid version of that?
Yeah, actually, It's a really interesting story, although, and I will get to it tonight, so I won't really.
I figured I'd tie in while we're talking about the shamans and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I just wanted to bring Pahman's name into the conversation at this point, so we sort of make sure that we're all familiar with who he was. He was the leading political leader, Native American Narragansett political leader in this area in the 17th century. He was also known in histories of King Philip's War as the ablest Narragansett soldier, which is something that will help us understand why he was a prominent figure at the time that he was. What does Pahman's name mean? He who travels by water.
What water did that tribe survive off?
I'm sorry?
You know the waters that tribe survived off besides the bay?
That's Warwick Cove.
Besides the bay, what other waters did they travel?
Oh.
Survive off.
Probably the same ones that we do.
There's a stream back there.
Right. I can see you're up on your Warwick natural history and history.
That's fucking good.
Yeah. Okay, the first European to arrive in this region, and certainly the first European to have made contact with the Native Americans who lived here, was Giovanni de Verrazzano, an Italian navigator. And he arrived in Narragansett Bay that he named Refugio as early as 1524, amazingly early. He spent 15 days in Narragansett Bay and was contacted by large numbers of native peoples who came to visit his ship by canoe. He counted one day some 20 or so canoes that had come from the shore where people were standing off there a little bit wary. But at the same time, they cheered him. They were a little bit afraid. They weren't quite exactly sure what this was. But in any event, it was a peaceful encounter. They seemed to have had some kind of trade. He was very interested and impressed by the way in which they comported themselves. He mentioned that they had two chieftains that represented them, which is a tradition that carried on into the 17th century. The Narragansetts, as we know them from the 17th century, were always led into war and for other purposes in their negotiations by two chieftains, usually an elder and a younger chief. And Verrazzano describes the Narragansetts in the following terms. This is the finest looking tribe and the handsomest that we have found in our voyage. He traveled up and down on the northeastern coast to a variety of places, I think as far south as Delaware. I forget exactly now what his entire itinerary was, but it's interesting that he said that. He was very impressed by the native peoples that lived on the edges of Narragansett Bay. If we try to reconstruct what their life was like at that time period, here in Warwick and Patuxent and Providence and the general region, we try to reconstruct what it was like. It's an extremely difficult task. There's archaeological reports. Archaeologists are interested in that problem. They've excavated sites throughout Rhode Island and the rest of New England. And we know that people were here, living here for probably something like 15,000 years conservatively, maybe even a little bit longer than that. We know that in those 15,000 years that human cultures changed substantially, that in the earliest days at the end of the last ice age that they were probably nomadic hunters who lived by hunting forms of Ice Age mammals that no longer live in this area or that are now extinct. But as time went by and the climate warmed, they became more and more attuned to living off the landscape, not so much depending on the large land mammals that were here at the end of the Ice Age, but rather on smaller game, on seafood, on shellfish, and so forth, until finally about 2,000 years ago or so, plus or minus maybe 500 years, the way of life in this region began to change because of the larger technological and ecological changes that were happening farther to the south in Mexico, in the southwestern United States, in the southeastern United States, where knowledge of agriculture began to spread farther up into the north. So by about 2,000 years ago, the Native American people living here were farmers. And not only did they practice agriculture, they also had learned the techniques of pottery making, of ceramics, that had been independently invented in the New World, in Mexico as well as in South America. And the knowledge of making ceramics diffused up to the north, not too much farther north, actually, than New England. By Maine and New Hampshire was about the northern limit for the diffusion of ceramics among the Native Indian peoples. But nevertheless, they did get to Rhode Island by about 2,000 or so years ago. There are many sites in Warwick, as well as elsewhere in Rhode Island, where Narragansett and pre-Narragansett ceramics are quite abundant. And one of those sites is the Sweet Meadow Brook site, which was excavated by the Narragansett Archaeological Society of Rhode Island in the 1950s. The Sweet Meadow Brook site is where the railroad trestle crosses West Shore Road just as you go around the corner. I'm really probably speaking from the Stone Age because I don't even know if it's there anymore, where the Appanock Diner was. So if you went around the corner underneath that railroad trestle, you notice to the left is going down West Shore Road. There's an area that's been completely excavated. It looks like it's a sand and gravel operation. There's nothing there now. It looks, at least it did the last time I saw it, looked like a desert. Well, that was a thriving Indian village right up until the historic period when Roger Williams and others arrived here. And it was a thriving village that gives that in a sense helps you understand the name of Appanog, which means in Narragansett the shellfishing place or the oyster roasting place or something along those lines. But that was a village where Narragansetts lived for centuries before the arrival of Europeans. You're welcome to look at these materials afterwards, but here's a little report. The Narragansett Archaeological Society in the 1950s was just a group of teachers and miscellaneous collectors and educated and just curious people that were interested in the Native archaeology of Rhode Island. They did a little site report on this. I, as a teenager, actually visited there once and saw what they were doing. I was very impressed with that. It had something to do with my becoming an anthropologist, I think. But anyway, to make a long story short, here are some outlines of the types of ceramic vessels that we could have expected the Narragansetts to have been using and making in this area at the time of the arrival of Europeans. So in terms of their material culture, we know a lot. They made their artifacts out of stone and wood. They also had understood the technology of ceramics. They grew corn, beans, and squash, the famous triumvirate of North American people. They had some metal, but it wasn't metal like iron that they worked and smelted and got out of ores and so forth. Rather, the metals that they used, and these were seen by Verrazzano, were native raw copper that were probably traded into this area from someplace else. But by and large, they were people whose entire technology depended on stone, leather, and wood, and ceramics. So technologically, we know a lot about them. We know a lot about their food. They lived on deer, rabbits, shellfish, as well as the farming products. So they made a very abundant life for themselves. It was not a difficult living. In the summers, they moved down the river valleys where they wintered. In the spring and summer, they moved down the valleys towards the sea. And the inland populations then spread out along the coastline. And each family and each lineage, each sachem, had their particular territory where they set up their summer camps, and these summer camps were usually along the water's edge. The wind would blow away the mosquitoes and so forth, and it would give you good visibility. It would be close to shell fishing. It would be close to net fishing and various other kinds of summertime fishing and marine-related activities. And so during the summer, if you were to travel along this coast at the time that Verrazzano did, you would see little villages spread out along the shoreline. Not continuously. I mean, the population wasn't that great. There were probably somewhere 15 to 20,000 people in Rhode Island at that time. But spread out along the shoreline, little clusters of houses here, little clusters of houses there. The houses, by and large, were semi-hemispherical structures that were called wigwams. It's interesting how many Narragansett words have filtered into the English vocabulary. We now use the word wigwam to refer to a Native American house, and wigwam was the Narragansett word for house, and it just simply became part of the English language as a word for describing a Native American house. But in any event, they lived in these little wigwams along the shoreline. They accumulated shell middens. Any of you have gardened in Conemaugh or Shawmut or Patuxent or someplace along this area, you probably noticed all sorts of broken shells in your yard. And if you didn't dump them there yourself as a consequence of a clam bake or something like that, there's a very good likelihood that these shells were just simply the debris from Indian campsites in this region throughout the summer and early fall months. Shell middens were a very characteristic aspect of Native American village sites, and that's one of the first things that archaeologists look for when they're trying to find archaeological remains. So material culture, we know a lot. For the rest of their culture, as I say, to try to understand what the Narragansetts or the Shawmuts or the Cohuesets or any of these people were like at this early time period, it's guessing. That is, we have to take works that were written in the 1600s. And of those works that were written in the 1600s, Roger Williams's Key to the Language of America is by far the most important. Roger Williams, as you know, was the founder of the original settlement of Providence on the banks of the Moshassic River, between the Moshassic River and College Hill. And Roger Williams arrived in 1636, and with discussions with Canonicus and Myantonomi and other Narragansett sachems, was given a gift of land. That is, it wasn't a transaction. It wasn't something that he took. It was rather something that was given to him by Canonicus and Myantonomi. And the tract of land that Roger Williams possessed included, by and large, the area of what is now the city of Providence and some of the city of Cranston. And the degree to which it extended, there's been a tremendous amount of controversy, as all of you may know, about deeds and who owned what back in that early time period. But by and large, the original tract of Providence went to the edge of the Patuxent River. Originally a little bit short of that, but eventually reached the edge of the Patuxent River on the south, probably about as far as the Pocasset River, where the Pocasset River comes into the Patuxent River towards the west. And then as you go farther north and west, Nuticunkin and Hill was the boundary in that direction. And then there's some other sites in Oneyville and Pawtucket and Lonsdale and so on that also marked the boundary of Roger Williams's tract in that direction. It was a very large piece of land. There were not a large number of Native Americans living on that land at that time, and that's kind of a puzzle to me as to why that was the case. But as you know, by the time Europeans began arriving in great numbers, 1615, 1618 or so, before the English originally settled at Plymouth, they communicated a large number of diseases to which the New England people had no natural resistance. So large areas were quickly depopulated. The Pilgrims, for example, noticed as they sailed around Cape Cod and the Puritans in Massachusetts, there were entire areas where the whole populations of villages had simply just died, and they were lied there unburied on the surface of the ground. And it's quite possible that something like that had affected the area of Providence, because there were not a lot of Native Americans that were living there at the time that Canonicus and Myantonomi gave that property to Roger Williams. Yes?
I just wanted to ask you, when you said that boundary was, I think, the Patuxent River, you're talking about the Patuxent Village, because that's where we come down to, right? The river there?
The Providence side of the river.
Yes.
I have a question about the deed. Now, I recall reading somewhere that Canonicus, and I guess like you had just educated me, other stations, other tribes, when they had, you said, given the land as a gift to Roger Williams. Right. My understanding from one place I had read that they didn't understand the concept of land possession. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but they understood it as it belonging to God, and that they were simply keepers of the land, and they didn't understand the ownership of land concept. It wasn't really something that was in their thinking so much. So that was my first question. My second question is...
First question was that did the Native Americans know what they were doing when they gave Europeans the right to use the land? The Europeans thinking that now they own it, and the Native Americans thinking now they're using it. Yes.
Yeah. So the second part was the original Providence plantation settlement that was given by Canonicus was much smaller than it was expanded later. And I think the boundaries, I think you said Pawtucket. Did you say Pawtucket? There were some villages up in Pawtucket, and it came down further south down to Cranston. Now, that was expanded later because the original one was much smaller. Was it not the original deed where you can see Canonicus's signature?
There were people living in the southern areas of Roger Williams's jurisdiction who claimed, I don't want to get into that because it's a very complicated business, but who did claim that the grant that Roger Williams got was in fact larger than Roger Williams knew, and that they owned that part that Roger Williams didn't know that he had. Sort of like that. Did you say, Henry, that sums it up?
Oh, so there wasn't two separate deals. There was one.
There were several different agreements, but the first one was, I think, in 1638, 2 years after Roger Williams arrived. So on the other side of the river, basically you've got the frontier of English settlement in this area, just as beyond Nuticconcunnon Hill, you also had the frontier of English settlement. And in Pawtucket, you had the frontier of English settlement in that direction, although there was Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay, they hadn't yet begun to inhabit that area. Okay, government. How were the Native Americans governed in this area? It's really interesting. In fact, this part of the world, this part of North America, I think is almost unique in this regard, in the sense that the actual names for the political and governmental jurisdictions have persisted into present nomenclature. If you go around Rhode Island, if you're a native Rhode Islander and somebody says where you're from, you don't say, maybe you do, but many don't. So you don't say, I'm from Warwick. You say, I'm from Athanag, or I'm from Conimicut, or I'm from Cohasset, or I'm from Pottawamat, or I'm from Mechanicut, or I'm from Pawtuxet, or something else. I mean, we can go on and on with these locations. And by and large, these Indian place names were little principalities. That is, they were areas that had their own leaders, their local families that lived there, that owned, that possessed those territories. And often the family names of those people who lived there were connected to the place itself. For example, the sachem Sakononiko, who lived in Pawtuxet, owned territories going up the river, including that territory as far as where the Reform School once was, you know, Sakonasset Hill out there in Cranston. And one of the linguistic interpretations of his name is that, in fact, he was named after that piece of real estate.
I've been talking to Susan Danforth at the John Carter Brown Library. She's been doing some research that might indicate that some of these Indian place names actually were given in the 19th century. They weren't contemporary to the historic period that you're talking about. Do you know anything about this work?
I can't say that I do. But if you go through the letters of Roger Williams, these names are all over. They were certainly in wide English usage in the 17th century.
I know Pawtuxet said it maybe up and up, but she said that there are an awful lot of place names in the Rhode Island that things were named later.
Yeah,
and this, some of this may be coming out of some work from the Pequot Museum Library too, which has quite a very good collection as well. And so this is something she shared with us. Susan Danforth from the John Carter
Question was, are some of these names really old Indian names, or are they in a sense invented traditions that somebody in the 19th century decided to make up? And it could be that there are some of those. I'd be interested to know what they are. But the names like Mechanicut or Pawtuxet or Conimicut and so forth, these are 17th century names. Musquamicut, Quanicantag, such places. They're names that go back to 17th century records. They're there from the beginning. And they've been there persistently right up until the present. So here we have these little areas, each of which had their own leadership and their own resident families, and the locations have survived within current usage, and it's really quite unusual that that happens. Many years that I lived in California, there are Indian names, but because of the different process of colonization, California, the great parts of it, for example, were colonized by the gold rush. And the gold rush was just thousands of people rushing in all of a sudden who really weren't interested in the place except to find out where the gold was. And if there was no gold there, they went on to someplace else. And the Native Americans basically were in the way, and they weren't interested in interacting with them very much. And they didn't learn much about the place. And when the time came when they began naming it, they named it after things that had to do with their own background and experience. The English did a lot of that too. I mean, they named places in Rhode Island after places in England. But at the same time, they lived in contact with Native Americans here in Rhode Island for 50 or so years on a relatively peaceful basis. 50 years, yeah, about 50 years. And during that time, a lot of linguistic, geographical knowledge, place name knowledge, just became part of the way in which the English began to view Rhode Island. So anyway, the point I'm making here is that the little political jurisdictions that existed here with Sachem Pomum, with Sachem Saukonanico, with Canonicus and My Antinomy and Connimicut and all of the others that names we know from that time period, each of these were political leaders of a sort. They were the head of little royal lineages that had responsibility for those territories and had, in a sense, ownership of the land. But at the same time, there was a governmental structure that sort of transcended all of that. And nobody knows for sure whether that governmental structure preceded the Europeans or not. But at the time Roger Williams came, Canonicus and My Antinomy were the leaders of all of the Narragansett. And all of the Narragansett at that time included the Niantic of Weecapog and Westerly in that direction. It included the Cohuesets, it included the Shawmuts, it included the Mashapogs, it included all of these different groups that lived here and there around Rhode Island. It did not include most of the Wampanoags, but by conquest it also included some of the Wampanoags from the other side of Narragansett Bay. So we have an interesting system where we have local rulers, as was Pomum and as was Saukonanico, but at the same time, above that, we had a higher echelon of leaders, as represented by Canonicus and My Antinomy. And once the English began to infiltrate and to make deals over land and so forth, they did, in fact, create tensions and rivalries, difficulties, hostilities within Native American society itself between the local leaders and the tribal leaders. That is, the local leaders might want to make a local alliance with the English or make a treaty with them or a trade of some sort, and the higher leaders may not have approved of that. Or vice versa, the higher leaders might have given away a property, as may have happened with Providence, that belonged to someone else at the local level, and the people at the local level signed the deed, but they didn't really want to do it, but they didn't have any choice because they were under the thumb of the overall chieftains. And that presumably was what happened here in Warwick with Pomum and Saukonanico. I'm not going to do well on that name. That's what happened here in Warwick with those two sachems. The English began making arrangements with these sachems. First of all, My Antinomy gave the land by treaty to one group of English, and then Pomum and Saukonanico then said afterwards that they, in fact, didn't really agree with that, and they were giving it to someone else, to William Arnold. And so there's a long history there of sort of missed cues and misunderstandings and so forth. But to make a long story short, you multiply what happened here locally to all of Massachusetts and Connecticut, and you've got a lot of stress within the Native American community itself, stress that's happening between Native American groups that hadn't happened before. But you've also got stress between the European groups themselves. But anyway, before I get to that, I want to say just a few more words. If you consider that the Narragansetts lived here for, say, 15,000 years, I think that's realistic. There was a continuity of people. And if you can even imagine that... if your grandparents or your great-grandparents lived in Warwick, and then your parents lived in Warwick, and then you live in Warwick, and then your children live in Warwick, you know an awful lot more about Warwick than someone does who moves here from Hyannis or Brockton or someplace. I mean, you know a lot. Just by almost not even trying, there's a huge amount of information that gets passed down to you and walks with your parents and just, you know, knowledge of your friends and so forth, place names and legends associated with things and so forth, and where certain kinds of animals live and what the flowers and the trees and the vegetation are and where certain rocks and fossils and whatnot can be found and so forth. If you live in a place long enough, you really, really get to understand it. So a fifth generation, a sixth generation English settler or native of Warwick gets to know a lot about the place, much more, much, much more than anyone who just moves here. A person who just moves here can go to the library and read a lot of things, but they don't have anywhere near the knowledge and the understanding does of a person who's acquired their knowledge through the generations. So you look at the Narragansetts, not 500 years now, not 300 years we're talking about, we're talking about infinity. That is the basically the populations that lived here for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So by the time Europeans arrived, what they interrupted, in a sense, was a culture that was quite specialized, quite refined in terms of its adaptation to the environment. They knew where everything was. They knew how to hunt for this. They knew where to gather what else in another season. They knew where particular minerals were. They knew where to get their water. They knew where to get their shellfish. But more than that, the culture itself within which they lived was much more integrated than the cultures that the Europeans brought to North America. If you look at the English, for example, they've been through the invasion, if you look at it, they went through invasion by Romans. They went through the conversion to Christianity. Then they went through the Reformation. Then they went through the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution and world trade and the rest of it. So by the time they arrived here, these English, although they seemed to be, by our standards, traditional people, they in fact were people who had been sort of jumped up and down, mixed up by a whole variety of historical circumstances, so that their cultures were in some ways very restless. I guess that's the word for it. Not altogether as integrated. Lots of factions within them, lots of divisions by social classes within them, lots of conflicts within them, political conflicts, religious conflicts. They were not an integrated people. The Native Americans who were living here at that time, they had political differences between them, territorial differences between them. The people knew where they lived and they defended their territories, but their religious ideas, their mythological ideas, their ideas of human kinship, their ideas of family, relationships, seasons, rituals, what happens to the soul in afterlife, ideas about the spiritual forces that animate nature and so forth, these ideas were very, very thoroughly worked out and very widely shared and very, very similar from one group to another. So what I'm saying is that without even knowing the details of what Native American cultures were like, we do know that by comparison to the Europeans, they were very organized, very patterned, in a sense the results of a long, slow process of cultural tradition and evolution. You had a question back there?
Well, yes, when you talk about the political structures, I've been trying to understand particularly the confederacies, and when you say there's this long history linguistically for the Algonquin, just how much else did they have in common? How much did they really function as a political unit, as you're suggesting, where there's higher leadership, which is somehow imposing their will, which is not quite my understanding of how Native cultures operated, but in comparison, say, to the Abenaki Confederacy or the Iroquois, how would you talk about the political structure of the Algonquin Confederacy? Because that would include these local tribes, but it was, were they part of something much larger in the way that you're suggesting?
Okay, I think that it is not known whether there was a confederacy, whether the Narragansetts as a group with a single leadership existed before the arrival of the English. That's what I'm trying to say. Nobody really knows that. But there's a Narragansett mythology that supports that, but what we really don't know is whether that's something that existed in pre-European times or that's something that resulted from the trading period
when some acquired firearms, others had territory where bears first could be hunted and so forth. And by simply by force of arms, that they were able to expand their territory.
Well, the Delaware were very powerful, and they were Algonquin as well, right? Which? The Delawares? So, again, as you talk about 15,000 years of history, I'm trying to see, what was there a relationship that spanned that larger territories?
Okay.
Way beyond just the Americans.
Okay. Okay. Now, we're getting far from Warwick on this, but in the areas where agriculture and ceramics and so forth appeared, in Mexico and in the southeastern U.S. and southwestern U.S., it increased the sizes of populations, it increased the density of populations, you began to develop urban types of cultures. Cities almost began to appear. And with these began something like what began to happen in Europe at the beginning of the Romans, that is conquests and empires and things of that sort. That hadn't yet reached this area. This area, I think, was still living on the edge of those developments that were taking place in the southeast and in Mexico.
The Iroquois Confederacy, I mean, I could be wrong on this, but I think that as we knew it as a military entity, it was a post-European development. So anyway, we have this development of peoples here, and by the time the Europeans arrived in the 17th century, they had begun to change dramatically. The Narragansetts that Roger Williams writes about in his Key to the Language of America are already people who had access to European medicines, they had access to European weapons, they had access to various other kinds of technology, they had even begun to learn English. As you know, the famous story of the Pilgrims, you know, getting off at Plymouth in 1620, and they ran into two Native Americans who came into their settlement speaking English. They had already been in touch with English fishermen and traders and travelers and so forth on the Atlantic coast, and the Native people were heavily influenced by the time that the English began to settle Providence. They had their own religious practitioners. They had their own systems of healing. They had their own ideas about folklore and mythology and so forth, and if you're interested in looking further into these, Roger Williams' Key to the Language of America is the single greatest source, I think, on sort of the details of Narragansett culture. And what he described for the Narragansett would have held for the Shawmuts, it would have held for the Cohuesets, it would have held for the Mashanticats, it would have held for the Patuxets, it would have held for all of these people. As you go farther and farther afield, you run into linguistic differences. That is, if you went from here to Connecticut, to the Thames River Valley, you'd find that the languages being spoken there were a little bit different from the languages that were being spoken here. So you go farther and farther away, the languages did change, but by and large, they were the same languages, and it was not difficult for a person who spoke one to travel into the countries of people who spoke the others and quickly pick up the dialect. What's interesting here in Warwick is that the conflicts that took place between Native Americans and English were more than local events. Some of it had to do with just the personalities. I think both Warwick and Providence attracted the personalities that were by nature probably not really that sociable. Providence was not laid out as a village square as it was done in many of the Puritan villages in Massachusetts around a village green where they had their houses and so forth. Providence was laid out, all the houses in a row along the river, so you didn't have to face your neighbors. They were somewhat less communal, but at the same time, okay, so we could say that they were a bunch of oddballs in some ways and independent people with their own religious ideas and no religious ideas and all sorts of people that had visions and whatnot. I mean, they were a real combination of people. At the same time, this wasn't just something that happened here locally. This was a reflection of England in the 1640s. England at the time that Rhode Island was settled, that Massachusetts was settled, was a country at war with itself. And it was at war with itself over religious reasons primarily, over land ownership reasons, over class differences to some extent, but it was largely being fought out in terms of religious differences. And the ways in which people distinguished themselves from others was in terms of religious beliefs and religious arguments. So those English who came here to New England were not a uniform bunch of people. We know that Roger Williams, when he came to Providence to begin with, came because he already had in some ways evolved beyond Puritan thought. The Puritans who came to America came here for freedom of religion. But of course, the paradox was that they had theirs, but since they figured that what they wanted was the real thing, to which there were no alternatives, if someone like Roger Williams came along and said, well, you know, I don't really believe this. I think that another way of interpreting this passage of the Bible or something, well, that was the passport to Rhode Island. And that's how, you know, Roger Williams with his 13 original settlers, they had sort of intellectual and religious backgrounds of that sort. You multiply that by maybe 10 and you've got Warwick. The people who ended up in Patuxent and Shawmut and so forth in this region were people who were more independent in some ways than the ones at Providence, in some ways even less religious than the ones at Providence, who were not that famous for being religious themselves. So as you move farther in this direction, you move farther in the direction of people who were sort of like the traditional American frontiersman. You know the story of the frontier. The guy who wants to move out and get a coonskin cap and move away from civilization and doesn't feel good until he's like in the mountains someplace living with bears or something. Well, this is a kind of a version of that, and that is that the less urban and the less communal and the less religious they were, the less orthodox they were, the more they wanted to move out into the frontier. And so the farther out you went, the more peculiar were the collections of people, I think, that began to locate there. So here in Warwick, then, you had Providence as its neighbor in 1636. I'm going to have to look at my notes for just a minute while I get into this because I don't have all the dates in my head. In 1643, my aunt Anomi, who had been responsible for the land transactions with Providence, my aunt Anomi then sells Shawmut to Samuel Gorton. And this treaty was also signed by Pomham, who was a sachem underneath the overarching leadership of my aunt Anomi. My aunt Anomi was the big chief here. He and Canonicus were the big ones. And Pomham was the local guy. And it was Pomham's land that my aunt Anomi was selling to Samuel Gorton. And Pomham signed it. But afterwards he said he had his fingers crossed that he didn't really mean it. or something like that. That same year, Pomham popped up again and he said, I didn't really mean it. And as evidence that he didn't mean it, he had the other sachem from Patuxent, Sakinonico, who said, I know he didn't mean it, and I didn't mean it either, and we just had to do it because my aunt Anomi told us to do it. And they said they didn't really intend to give this land away. And as a way of protecting themselves from my aunt Anomi, as well as from the English in a sense, they submitted themselves to the jurisdiction of Massachusetts Bay Colony. So here we have these people who were largely an outgrowth of Providence moving into Warwick, who are refugees from Massachusetts. And here we have this local sachem whose land was being given away under his name with his approval, but he didn't really approve it. And so what he figured, well, how am I going to, you know, and this is going on all over the frontier where such things were happening. How am I going to deal with this? He was a very smart man. And he was, as I said, he was also the Narragansett's best soldier. He wasn't anyone to fool with. He sent an embassy, William Arnold. He and Sakinonico went to Massachusetts Bay and they submitted themselves to the Puritan leadership of Massachusetts Bay, who were a very powerful political organization. They had soldiers, they had firearms. They could have erased Providence in a day had they chosen to do it. But actually, they liked Providence being here because Providence was sort of their briar hedge, as they called it, protecting the residents of Massachusetts Bay from those people beyond the frontier. So if there was to be an Indian invasion of Massachusetts, they'd have to go through Providence first, and the people in Massachusetts Bay liked that. So anyway, Pomham made a deal with the Massachusetts Bay General Court that he would be their subject. So now we have, right here in the midst of the Providence and Rhode Island colony, we have an outpost of Massachusetts Bay Colony. say, then Samuel Gorton gets arrested for a while, and he's incarcerated up there in Boston. I don't know exactly what he did, but I'm sure someone here might be able to fill me in on that. I tried reading his Simplicity's Defense, and if anyone can understand that, I'd really like to be given a kind of a summary at some point. But anyway, he was incarcerated for a while, and when he came back to Warwick, he spoke with Canonicus and Pessicus and Mixano, and he said, well, who were very upset because of this local rebellion on the part of the Warwick people, the Patuxet and the Shawmut people. He was very upset about that. The Narragansetts were upset about that. They felt if they were to go in there and attack Pumham, that they would have Massachusetts Bay on their neck. And so Samuel Gorton said, I'll tell you what to do. He said, don't bother with Massachusetts Bay. Providence is too weak. They can't really help anybody. Submit yourself to King Charles I of England. So that's what the Narragansetts did. They submitted themselves to King Charles I of England. They became English subjects. So the first time that the Narragansetts gave up their sovereignty, it wasn't to the laws of Providence or the laws of Massachusetts Bay. When the Narragansetts surrendered their sovereignty, they surrendered it to King Charles I. That was in 1644. When that happened, Massachusetts Bay then figured, well, Pumham's now a little worried. He was biting his nails down there at Warwick Neck and here and there because he felt he really had the trump card, and now he no longer had it. And so Massachusetts Bay sent a garrison down of soldiers with firearms and so forth and axes and whatnot, and they built Pumham his little fort there in 145 Payne Avenue here in Warwick, where he could defend himself in event the Narragansetts ever decided to attack. So that's the story of the origin of all of that. But what's interesting, you'd think that these alliances would solve problems rather than create problems, but it worked the other way around. The Puritans were here in Rhode Island, in Massachusetts, or in New England generally, because of the Civil War that was going on in England and because of the conflict of religious beliefs that were going on in England. Some of the Puritans left. The mild-mannered ones, I guess you could say, they got out of England, they moved to Massachusetts. And the tough ones stayed, and they challenged the king. That was Charles I, to whom the Narragansetts submitted themselves. Charles I had the misfortune to have had as his primary adversary in the English Civil War none other than Oliver Cromwell, who was probably England's greatest soldier from that day. And it wasn't long before Charles I's head went rolling in London. He was captured in several battles, the Parliament versus the King and so forth, you know, the English Civil War with Cavaliers and Roundheads and the New Model Army and so on. So here was a war going on in England. Narragansetts aligned themselves with the King, therefore creating really bad relations with all of those other people in Providence as well as in Boston who were Puritans, who felt that the king should be beheaded. They had absolutely no respect for it. They felt he had defiled England, that the Puritans were the people who really were going to be the successors to the royalty of England and so forth. And so what the Narragansetts did was they stepped into a real controversy that was fighting its way out in the old world, but was strongly felt by those people here in the new world. So the Narragansetts submit to Charles I, and immediately they became enemies to Massachusetts Bay Colony. I mean, Puritans could not possibly like an Indian tribe that not only was a potential danger to them, but also were allied with their enemies. And so this helps explain some of Warwick's reputation for being a place where nobody could get along in the 1640s. And I'm just going to read you one of Roger Williams's letters that describes sort of like a little slice of what life was like here. I think it was 1655. So we've got all these treaties going on. We've got these alliances. We've got these hatreds. We've got these fears and forts being built and guys running around, you know, telling secrets on one another and so forth. So anyway, Roger Williams writes a letter to the General Court of Massachusetts on the 12th of May, 1656. You can tell from this letter that things had started to go downhill. I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs. Honored sirs, our first request, in short, was and is for your favorable consideration of the long and lamentable condition of the town of Warwick, which hath been thus. They are so dangerously and so vexatiously intermingled with the barbarians that I have long admired the wonderful power of God in restraining and preventing very great fires of mutual slaughters breaking forth between them. This was the Roger Williams who in 1643 wrote The Key to the Language of America, which is one of the more tolerant, understanding, sort of culturally relative, progressive views of Native American culture that had ever been written during the colonial period. Here's Roger Williams 12 years later or so, changing his tune a little bit. The remedy is under God, only your pleasure, that Pomum shall come to an agreement with the town or colony and that some convenient way in time be set for their removal. He wants to just simply kick Pomum out of town. And there were lots of efforts on the part of the Warwick people to do that, but Pomum was a very, very cagey individual and they never, ever really succeeded. He was here right up until King Philip's War, doing all kinds of things that irritated various English settlers. Please do not be insensible of the slippery and dangerous condition of this, their intermingled cohabitation. He's not talking about some kind of sexual thing. He's just talking about the fact that in Warwick, it was an unusual situation where the native peoples claimed they owned the land and the English claimed they owned the land, and they were all living on it together. In most places where the English lived, the natives didn't live. They went to separate places. In Warwick, they were pretty much intermingled. I am humbly confident that all the English towns and plantations in all New England put together, this is a pretty big generalization, suffer not such molestation from the natives as this one town and people. It is so great and so oppressive that I have daily feared the tidings of some public fire and mischief. And then finally, this is still to the General Court of Massachusetts in 1656. Please you to be informed that this small neck wherein they keep and mingle fields with the English is a very den of wickedness, where they not only practice the horrid barbarisms of all kind of whoredoms, idolatries, and conjurations. Now, whoredoms, idolatries, conjurations. Roger Williams knew that they had kinship and marriage systems that were different from those of the English. In The Key to the Language of America, he described those for what they were. As a judgmental English Puritan, he's looking at those and saying that they're immoral. In other words, even Roger Williams is turning against the natives of Warwick here. Idolatries and conjurations, the same thing. Roger Williams recognized that they had their own mythology, their own religious beliefs, their own healers, so forth, their own systems of medicine and all of that. But by now, 1656, this has become idolatry and it's become conjurations. He's just totally dismissing the possibility that they're capable of being saved. But living without all exercise of actual authority and getting stores of liquor to our grief, there is a confluence and rendezvous of all the wildest and most licentious natives and practices in the whole country. The whole country. So that's right here. So you don't have to be a conjurer to figure out that this doesn't lead to a happy ending. The relations that we're seeing here in Warwick were being played out in their own way in relations around Plymouth, in relations around New Bedford, Swansea, Rehoboth, other areas of New England, even here in the Narragansett country, elsewhere in Rhode Island. These types of disagreements, hostilities, cultural misunderstandings, greed, selfishness, land grabbing, and the rest of it, these things were happening on a fairly widespread scale, but Warwick was a place where they were kind of like in the avant-garde. By 1675, it had really gotten bad, and people, the English had been expecting for about 5 years that warfare would break out. The main issue by 1675 was whose court lawbreakers would get tried under. That is, if an Englishman were to do something to a Native American, the Native Americans felt that he should be tried under their jurisdiction. English claimed that the guy should be tried under their jurisdiction. If a Native American did something, the English would try it under their jurisdiction, so forth. So finally, it all began to break down. The English had been seeing prophecies in the sky They were very superstitious people, despite the fact that they were Puritans and religious and all of that. And for a period of several years, they heard cannons going off. They saw armies marching around. They saw cloud formations that looked like bows and arrows firing arrows across the sky and so forth. And they heard loud thundering noises and whatnot. And this sort of built up, and the English felt that at a certain point that all of this was leading to war. Sure enough, by 1675, war did break out in Swansea. It started on a fairly small scale, but relations were so bad in so many parts of New England that what started on a small scale ignited into something that was really large scale very quickly. And what really ignited it, but at the same time in a sense turned the tide, was here's Massachusetts Bay up there. They're looking at all the land that the Narragansetts hold. They're looking at these Narragansetts who've become a powerful people. They're armed. They have a lot of authority over other Native Americans. In a sense, they had a kind of protection by being in Rhode Island. Massachusetts Bay Colony people were afraid that the Narragansetts were going to be a real tip the balance of power with Native Americans and English in New England. So they began to prepare a preemptive attack on the Narragansetts. And what led to that, what made that attack happen, was that as warfare began in Massachusetts, Plymouth, and that general area, Wampanoags began to flee to Rhode Island. And when that happened, then the English demanded that the Narragansett give up those refugees, and the Narragansetts refused to do that, and so the English took that as a declaration of war. So in December of 1675, the United Colonies put together an army of 1,000 or so men. They came from Connecticut, they came from Plymouth, they came from Massachusetts Bay. They did not come from Rhode Island, but they converged on Rhode Island. The Plymouth people came over land, they came over the Seekonk River, they came to Providence, and they walked down to Warwick. Various Massachusetts and Connecticut people, they came by boat to various places. They reconnoitered at Richard Smith Garrison at Wickford, at Kokomcusick, and then on December 15th, they marched into where the Narragansetts had retreated into the Great Swamp site, which was their big hiding place. And as you know, that ended with the destruction of the Narragansetts on December 19, 1675. Large numbers of Narragansetts were destroyed at that fort. The swamp that they were hiding in froze, and they had intelligence as to how to get in there. And it was an impenetrable place, and that's why the Narragansetts felt relatively safe. They hadn't finished the fortifications by the time the army from the United Colonies had arrived there. They found a way into the Palisades. So in a day and a night, an afternoon and a night, they burned down the defenses. They killed large numbers of people. The Narragansetts then got out of there, those that could, and escaped off into the woods, different directions. And they combined with Nipmucks and other people all the way up to Maine and to Canada who were enraged for similar purposes. And a very large-scale conflagration took place all over New England. By this time, by 1675, Pomham had spoken up, I guess, had passed away. He just disappears from the record. Maybe he retired in Florida, I don't know. But anyway, he doesn't show up in the record. Pomham was still around. He must have been in his 60s. I don't know. Let's figure that he was like a 30-year-old maybe or so. Had to have been maybe 30-year-old at the time of all these goings on in the 1640s. So by the 1670s, he's in his 60s plausibly, five or so years, maybe 10 years even in either direction. I don't know. But he wasn't, you know, a college athlete at that point. But anyway, he knew where his friends were. By 1675, Pomham was back with the Narragansetts. When the Narragansetts prepared for war, that's where he was. I mean, whatever all these hostilities were, these rivalries, the rest of it, they had figured out that it was us versus them. And the English also felt that Pomham, the people of Massachusetts Bay felt that Pomham, their old friend and ally, the first thing they wanted to do was to get rid of him. And so when they came down to attack the Great Swamp, the convergence of armies to attack the Great Swamp fight site, the Plymouth branch, led by Josiah Winslow, came by way of Providence to Patuxent to find Pomham, because Pomham was still living here at that time, to find Pomham and his men and to destroy them. That was their first goal before attacking the Narragansetts, was to kill Pomham and get rid of his people. Needless to say, Pomham was elsewhere at the time. He wasn't waiting for them. He was no longer in his little fort, which is smaller than this room. Nobody knows where he went. But anyway, the English came looking for him, but they didn't get him. And I'm going to just give you I spent today going through the primary sources by different Puritan soldiers and participants in this fight in King Philip's War, and I tried to pull out those things that had to do with Warwick and those that had to do with Pomham's people. And so for the next couple of minutes, I'm just going to read you a quick fast-forward through King Philip's War from the point of view of Warwick and from the point of view of the Indians of Warwick. Okay, December 12th, Josiah Winslow, in charge of the Plymouth Force, en route to the Narragansetts, marched through Pomham's country in Warwick, hoping to capture him. Here's a letter from Joseph Dudley, who was a soldier in that force, who was instructed by Winslow to write a report on to Washington, to Boston or someplace. I don't know where his report went. I am commanded by the general to give your honor account of our proceedings since our last note from Patuxent. In the Sabbath evening, we advanced with the whole body for Mr. Carpenter's with the intent to surprise Pomham and his party at about 10 or 12 miles distance, having information by our Warwick scouts of his seat, that is, of his location. This does not speak well, by the way, for Warwick scouts. But the darkness of the night and the difficulty of our passage, and here's a very delicate diplomatic turn of phrase, and the unskillfulness of our pilots, i.e. the scouts, we passed the whole night and found ourselves at such a distance yet from them that we diverted and marched on to Mr. Smith's, which is in Wickford. So this was the beginning of King Philip's War in Warwick. On December 27th, after the Great Swamp Fight had happened, that was December 19th, as you remember, Captain Thomas Prentice from Massachusetts Bay made a march into Warwick also to attack Pomham. Couldn't find Pomham again, destroyed 100 wigwams. January 27th, looking at now George Bodges, Soldiers in King Philip's War, he says they despoiled the home of William Carpenter. And this is the account of the destruction of William Carpenter's home. They had intelligence that 300 Indians had been at Patuxent, an English plantation on Narragansett Bay, where they burnt Mr. Carpenter's corn and hay and all his houses. This is from a contemporary from that period, that is a soldier in King Philip's War, wrote this account. They burnt Mr. Carpenter's corn and hay and all his houses except his dwelling house, which likewise they had set on fire, but it was again quenched by some English that were in it. They likewise drove away with them 180 sheep, 50 head of large cattle, and 15 horses. Besides, they took much cattle from young Mr. Andrew Harris, and killed a servant of his. And William Hubbard, another Puritan historian, writing at the same time, says about this same attack, as they marched after the enemy, that is, as the pursuing force came to Warwick to try to drive these attackers out, as they marched after the enemy, they found a good house burned with a barn belonging to it. They perceived also that the enemy dealt much in horse flesh, meeting with no less than 60 horses' heads in one place, which they had left behind them. Our soldiers in pursuit came upon their rear, killed and took about 70 of them. So it's clear that what's going on here in midwinter, the local villages have been burned. They didn't have their grain supplies that they used to live through the winter. They're now living off the English domestic animals. Okay. July 27th, 1676, another soldier writes, Warwick, a town near Providence, seated upon a neck of land, environed by the sea, was all of it burned by the enemy at several times. The chief mischief there done was upon March 16th, 1676, and the place wholly deserted by the inhabitants for a time. Yet, but only one man killed, and he was because he was too confident of his own safety, as was said. So someone obviously walked out and said, I'll be all right. Finally, Pomham was killed with his son in Dedham, Massachusetts, July 27th, 1676. This is as the war is winding down. Philip himself was killed in August of 1676. So the war is near an end. They've run out of food. They've been hunted all over the place. They're losing morale. Anyway, the tide had really turned in the war. Upon the 27th of July, it was about 20 Indians were slain and 30 taken prisoners. We had 25 English and 20 of our Indian friends in this exploit. One of those that was slain was Pomham. So this is a group of Massachusetts Bay Puritan soldiers. Puritans in Massachusetts Bay and the Plymouth, and also in Plymouth, had Christian Indians on their side. By that point, they had already converted a number of local people, Indian people, to Christianity. Rajah Indians had never converted anyone. They're different. That's another whole story. But there were Christian Indians fighting in King Philip's War against the non-Christian Indians. So that's what happened. Pomham was caught by a group of English Massachusetts Bay Puritans with Christian Indian auxiliaries. After he had received, this is an account of Pomham's death. After he had received a deadly shot in his back, he withdrew himself from his men, for they were all relations and subjects that were taken at this time. So in other words, Pomham was out there fighting somewhere up by Dedham, and everyone who was with him was a kinsman. That is a tribal member or a family member. So that's how the fighting was done. They were local sachems with their local groups that followed them until the end. They were all his the relations and subjects. They were taken at this time. So basically here in Dedham, it sounds to me as if the male population of Warwick at that point was pretty well eliminated. And he thought to hide himself in a bushy hole, that is Pomham, after he was shot. He hid himself in a bushy hole. But he was found out by an Englishman who, as he went to apprehend him, found that the stout sachem was unwilling to fall into the hands of the English, for he gave him a stunning blow with his hatchet, which he had reserved of all of his weapons, and perhaps had slain the Englishman, but that God ordered it so that the Englishman had a sudden revival and took courage and grappled with him and threw him under him, and others coming to his assistance, Pomham was dispatched. And then another historian writes at the time that he was considered by the English the ablest soldier of the Narragansetts of his day. So that's basically the demise of Pomham and the defeat of those Warwick Native Americans who were involved in King Philip's War. And it's not to say that there weren't people that survived in Warwick after the war, as there were throughout all of Rhode Island. Largely, the Native Americans were concentrated in the south, where a reservation was created for Narragansetts. But there were pockets of Narragansetts living in Warwick and Cranston and Johnston, all over the state in that period after King Philip's War, that either had been neutral in the war, had been allied with various colonial families, whatever, some on Aquidneck Island. There were pockets of Native Americans that did survive. So we have a current situation today where there are a lot of Narragansetts in Charlestown, but yet there are people of Narragansett descent all over Rhode Island. And as late as the 19th century, they were still holding powwows and rituals and so forth, various kinds of activities in other places other than the Narragansett church site on the reservation in Charlestown. So anyway, I've reached the end of what I want to say about Warwick, but what I'd like to do is show 10 quick slides, and I know we're running late, and then if we have time for questions, I'd be happy to go ahead with them.
Now, everybody stay put, so you're real dog.
Okay, first time. Samuel de Champlain, I forget what year this is, but it's around 1615, maybe a little earlier, reconnoitered New England to see whether or not it might be possible to be New France, and was looking at various harbors and places along the coast. And as part of his mapping of New England harbors, he drew Native American villages along the way. And this is just one of his maps, but it shows you what it must have looked like here in Rhode Island. This is Plymouth, Massachusetts. This is Plymouth Harbor. And he did a series of others, but anyway, it gives you an idea. There's a little wigwam with the smoke coming out the top, with corn in the front. The village sort of gathered around this little tidal inlet.
Who was it that made the map?
Question louder, please.
Who was the man who made this
Samuel
map?
Samuel de Champlain. He was reconnoitering the New England coast to determine whether or not the French wanted to colonize it, where the good places would be. I think he named Plymouth Louisville. I forget now. But anyway, he gave it a French name on his map. But a name, of course, didn't survive after 1620. Here's the title page to Roger Williams' Key to the Language of America. If you have one book, you want to have one book on your library in Rhode Island, this is the book. Published in England in 1643 when he went back to get the charter for Providence.